My tips now is to... This is one of the things I think my learnings personally is to leave early.
I know your October months should end off lives.
Not only October, I think, Philip.
In general.
Yeah. In general, yeah. I even had to do like manufacturing in a short period. I never necessarily liked or excelled at it.
I think you announced from this week that you raised $45 million, if I convert in dollars. It's a private placement with new international, international investors.
We are also so happy with the data we have on the DNA. So let's see if that's, maybe more likely that we would explore with a partner with them or in a competence.
Hey, I'm your host, Philip. Welcome to a new episode of the Flood Bio Show, where I interview the best Europeans in biotech to help you grow. Today, I'm in the really cold and wintry Oslo to talk with Agnete Fredriksen from Nycode, so ex-Vaccibody. Agnete founded the company, this immunotherapy company, in 2006, and the company is now worth around $500 million. I've known Agnete for several years, and I like her sharpness while having this like Scandinavian humility. We will talk about being one of the leading women in biotech in Europe, about immunotherapy and about the Nordics. So let's go to her office somewhere in this building and talk to her. See ya. All right, so for today, I want to start with talking about like women in biotech, a general topic. I mean, you're actually the first woman guests on the show. And I took the ranking, but I would rank you, I think, in the top, let's say, 50 women in biotech in Europe, according to myself. And I'm curious on what's your experience like?
Being a woman?
Being a leading woman in biotech. The field there.
I don't necessarily think about it that much every day. Yeah. But definitely there's been episodes where you feel that you're treated differently. So I've started to think that it's important to start to talk about the differences, even though some of them are more general than person specific, in order just to figure out how we can make it more attractive for more women to enter into leadership positions in biotech. I think it's important not to just say it's no difference. You just have to want to be a leader in biotech as a woman. I think you do experience differences.
What happened? What made you change from I just don't want to talk about it to I want to share more? Is there something that happened?
No, I think, you get to a certain level of position or confidence that I feel that I missed to hear from other women that were in front of me, that they actually talked about the differences. Because I felt when I was younger that what I heard was that there is no difference also from women in leadership positions. And then I felt that I experienced differences. And that I actually felt was a bit unfair because I felt that I would be better prepared if someone actually talked about it in public or to me specifically, so that I could also feel that it was not like only my experiences were unique. And also that you can be more prepared to handle it.
Must be also a bit confusing if you hear from leading women it's the same, and if your experience is not the same, must be like, oh, is it me?
Exactly. Yeah. So I guess I just realized that I don't want to have that burden put on the next generation of women coming after me.
Yeah.
So I'm happy to tell them, and in private or to some extent in public, that there are differences and there are ways I've learned how to handle them.
Yeah.
And there are things I cannot change myself, and there are things that I think I know how to handle, which makes it easier for the next generation.
Oh, that's great. Can you share maybe what you can, maybe some lessons or some things you want to share publicly, especially things that were in your control and that you could influence?
Yeah, I mean, so I think I don't necessarily feel that I personally have experienced too much difficulties in the professional settings. Also, I mean, obviously when you enter a room, there are people, if you're not known to them, that normally can treat you as you're not the the founder and CBO or CSO or something. So, but that normally can change within a couple of minutes. And I think recent years, most of the people I've met already know who I am, if it's in a professional setting. So I haven't experienced that too much personally, but I know it's an issue.
Yeah. It's interesting. How do you, in that example, how do you handle it? Like do you behave in a certain way? How do you handle it?
No, I think there it just helps to be prepared so that you don't have to be agitated in that setting and just, you know, hi and introduce yourself. And it also helps, obviously, to be with colleagues that you know you're, treat you as who you are and support that aspect of it. And maybe that is aware of it. So I think for me, it's been important also to talk about these differences with my closest colleagues so that we are all prepared and can handle the situation in a way that I also feel is with some dignity in that setting. But then I think that the more we move into something that is a bit more social and networking, that's maybe where I felt it has been much more challenging. And I think that's important also for other women to know about, particularly younger women in those settings. I think those social networking events are set up primarily by men and how they like to network. And I think I've been very, you know, stubborn that I should not have less opportunities to be in those settings and also do, you know, get connections in this networking events, but it's not easy.
They're very precious for business as well. I mean, that's where
networking
of the parties at JP Morgan, at Buy Europe, that's where you make also really good connections, business connections.
Exactly. But they are not necessarily set up for doing that across the genders.
Yeah.
And you know,
what's your
No, my tips now is to,
learnings there for, yeah.
This is one of the things I think my learnings personally is to leave early. So I don't know how to change that immediately and also to be close with colleagues and not be there alone. Then I think to some extent it works, but I don't think you have the opportunity the same extent to make new connections with people that you didn't know before in those kind of settings as a female. Which, you know, and then we can always joke about, you know, hunting or mountain biking. And I both hunt and I do mountain biking, but I'm never invited to those kind of networking events that is not a party. Those are, in principle, I feel, for males, connecting with other males. So I'm joking about, you know, should we set up a knitting cafe? Or, you know, should we have breakfast meetings with, you know, poetry over there? I mean, there are, I don't know. But these settings, there's a lot of these settings that are set up where males have the opportunity to connect and get new connections. Where we are a bit excluded. So that part just feels that you have to focus on the more professional settings. Sometimes I think it's unfair and limits the opportunities for us. But we're slowly getting there, I hope.
I think overall the situation is, I would say, quite improving, probably not fast enough, but still, I think improving. Everybody curious to hear on your side of, I mean, I remember from the, I think it was JP Morgan, I think it was the 2016, the scandal.
Yeah, exactly.
Big. I mean, it was a woman strippers at the party, which is definitely not made for us.
It's not made for us. You know, it's really not made for us.
Yeah. Did you see any change since then? I mean, it's been over 5 years. Did you see something like changing?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, from the early years when I started this, 2010, 11, 12, 13 was outrageous, I think, to some extent.
Worse, yeah.
But so I think it's slowly changing. But, you know, I mean, people are used to this. There's a lot of people that's been in the industry for a long period of time. And they're not necessarily there to talk business if there's a woman in the room, for good and bad, or mostly, I think, for bad. So I mean, and it's obviously not everyone, yeah. But it just makes you as a woman a bit more on the edge in these settings, because you definitely just have one ambition, and that is to also connect. I mean, we are as special person. It's a business setting. We also want to talk to people, and we want to joke and have fun with people we know partly and that we haven't met before, that we would like to make a connection with. And that can improve, please. Yeah.
I think what you are raising as well, the like talking to your colleagues, male or female, but about the reaction and how to, or what's kind of in the, I guess, in the, what's in the control of the group to improve. I think it's super important. But I think also even now raising it up, also for men listening to be more conscious. I mean, I can talk for myself, like, I there are a lot of things that I don't really notice. Mm. Something I would not notice. I'm not aware of it.
No.
But once I'm becoming aware of it, then it's also easier to change. I mean, more from like some events, I would not be really aware that it's like made for men, or that some women will feel uncomfortable. Mm. But once I'm aware of it, then I can also change it or help change it at my
own level. Yeah, and I think that's, you know, it's not always fun to talk about these things, I think. But I feel that we are a bit obligated to talk about the differences. I think we also talked about it, about hiring. And realizing that, you know, I'm an ambitious woman. I like people to be surrounded by other people around me with the passion to get things done. Mm. And also, you know, in many settings, I do appreciate it if something happens urgently and we can discuss things at 9 p.m. in the evening. And realizing lately that with those kind of wishes, and you give those kind of wishes to a recruiter searching for someone that would be a new employee, that would be more men that say, I'm happy to be available, and obviously I will always be there and work also at 9 p.m. if it's something and I'm so passionate. Well, a lot of you lose some women in the process just because they're getting a bit concerned, yeah, naturally. But then again, once they're hired, you don't necessarily experience the difference on the gender basis, is in my experience. So it's something about how we approach it when we recruit and how the recruiter approaches it. And trying to also see through the filters of how we naturally just behave, potentially a bit different. I mean, obviously there are exceptions, but between the genders on some of these differences between how we just respond to those kind of questions.
But do you think, I guess, and so it's a good example. I think, I guess you can mention that the, let's say the potential employee can respond differently, but I guess the potential employer could also ask a bit differently. I mean, it can be on both.
Exactly. Sides, yeah. And you have to both ask the question, not in a way that favors how men like to display themselves, but not necessarily follow up. So that's at least some of my experiences, that it's very tough for a woman to say, yes, I'll do this and I will always be there and I will perform day and night and 24 hours a day if they know they cannot, you know, fill it up with actions in the end, they are don't necessarily like to overpromise. And you can experience that in the other aspect with some that come into an interview and say, I'm happy to overpromise. Maybe there is, on a general gender basis, more men that overpromise than women, particularly women with families. So they don't necessarily feel it's a good day if they've been in an interview, come home to their husband and say, I overpromised in this interview that I will be available every day, even though we all know that I need to pick up children in the kindergarten or whatever. But maybe that's not necessarily the same the other way. So then in the end, maybe the woman is at least as diligent in following up in my experience. So I think at least I've been more open to start talking about it. I know some women say, we shouldn't talk about the differences because it's all generalized and there are so many exceptions. But I don't think we change it if we don't start to discuss it.
I mean, yeah, it is super complex topic. I like you, I mean, the example, and I think I saw what one study from a big consulting agency for Harvard Business Review, some about that one major factor of the salary difference, I think was for the US, was actually connected to overselling or being too humble or too like allowing oneself. And that this had a huge impact on salary negotiation. I was quite surprised actually. Well, I was in a US setting, but I guess we are not talking, you know, a cultural difference, but because if you're in the gender and cultural difference,
yeah,
it becomes multi-complex.
I'm not an expert on this and statistics and everything. It's just some of those things I've been starting to experience myself. That I seem to also get a lot of, when I talk to a recruiter, the ones that are presented to me are dominantly men. Yeah. And then starting to realize maybe that's also due to the fact that I'm telling this recruiter how I want my new employee to behave. Yeah. And then slightly changing it, and then you see a difference.
No, that's interesting. I mean, on the statistic, on this topic, I mean, it's a very, I think, quite subjective topic, and
yeah,
we have some stats, but it's not like science. I mean, you cannot measure it and reproduce it, but still, I think having a bit of stats data or some studies is probably better than those, even though I'm sure the studies contradict themselves, like a lot in social science studies where.
Absolutely. And you know, there's like, there are as many different men as there are different women. So you know, it shouldn't be a general topic, but maybe there are something that can
what's interesting is when you have some statistic cut with your own personal experience, and I guess your personal experience is not only once, it's like several times and recurring, then it starts to be a bit more like a trend and more solid than just a stat or just a single experience. And I'm curious about the also more from where we are, Scandinavia, Norway, Scandinavia. I have the feeling that, and I think there are some studies also there that gender diversity in Scandinavia is better than the rest of Europe or than the US. I mean, first thing that comes to my mind is the prime ministers, Finland, woman prime minister, Norway. But I think. Well, I think most of the Scandinavian countries had a woman prime minister, which is not the case of a lot of other countries, France, did this, like, I guess, have an impact, or how much did it have an impact on you?
Do
you agree?
I mean, I think it's also a lot of, you know, gender equality has come further, I think, in the European countries. It's everything from the opportunity for maternity leave, paternity leave, which is also sort of more or less mandatory in our countries. It's also about the cost of kindergarten being much less. So it obviously stimulates that women do go back to work and everything. I don't necessarily feel that I had an experience that there was a difference in my career opportunities until I started to travel out of Norway. So definitely there are, I think Norway has come much, much farther than that. And I think when I travel,
in Norway / Scandinavia, you didn't feel it, but
no.
You felt it much more when you went outside.
Yeah, okay. Particularly this, you know, if you establish some business relationships with people in France, for instance, and then after a year or something, you start to talk about, you know, I have 3 kids at home, and you see the shock in their face, which is, you know, I think it's pretty normal here that you do go to work and you can also travel, etc. Even though you have kids, it's a different community. It's not supposed to be different here if you are male or female in the normal settings. But you experience that's a shock for more people in the international world.
Oh. And the shock is more like from they're surprised, or also a shock, and it changes the business relationship.
I don't think I felt that it changes the business relationship. I just feel that it's like it's almost like they're judging you as to, I would not allow my wife to travel when we have kids or something in that respect. And I think maybe also some curiosity. So who is taking care of the kids? You know, are the kids fine? Do they grow up? I don't know. It feels like something like, my kids are so beautiful and so smart and so happy. So obviously that makes it easier for me also to travel. But it's differences. And I think, so it's interesting when you talk about prime minister and all these things where there is a lot of gender equality, as you say, in our countries. But it's also interesting in what I've experienced lately, because we do have some contacts with politicians, the amount of support they are offered. As to, there are always someone there prepping them, helping them, getting there to the next meeting, making sure everything is in place, etc. Which I think to some extent is also a bit comforting or attractive for women that enter into these leadership positions. And, you know, I'm starting to experience it more, as you may have seen today, compared to like 5 years ago, when you have to do everything yourself. And you have to order your flight tickets, and you have to make sure you come to every single meeting in time. And, you know, you need to have the logistics. You have to pay the bills and approve, and you have to do everything, which is, you know, demanding. It's as busy now. But I do also have people that support me through the day and make sure that all the important stuffs are taken care of.
Yeah.
So that's.
But you think in the political world, they have more support.
But you experience them when they come in here. I mean, there is always someone sitting next to them in a taxi that has prepped them for the next meeting.
Right.
This is the topic. You should remember these things. This is the things you're supposed to say here. And then, you know, they come and say, now the time is 10:54 and now we have to leave and I'll guide you to the next, etc. So that they can spend their time doing exactly what they're best at and not also simultaneously having to do all the other stuff. And that's not the case with the founder position.
Yeah.
You don't have any support in the beginning, and you have to fight quite a lot. You have to stand up for your own opinions in front of, you know, investors, partners, employees, etc. So that may make it a bit more challenging for women in that early phase where you just have to do everything yourself.
Yeah. I'm curious if because I experienced that myself as a founder as well, where we would like do a lot of things, and at some point we had to switch, especially at Labiotech when the team was growing and we invested a bit more in support functions.
Yeah.
Especially like a team support who could handle like a lot of different things. Mm. And this was really game changing for us as founders. But as male founders, but I think as women founders, there's also this learning curve of like, okay, a lot of small tasks. And when you accumulate it takes a lot, a big chunk of time.
It does, yeah.
And also mental time, etc. Yeah. And having someone who can handle this.
It's also stressful, right? Yeah. Because you have to think about all these additional topics while you are actually trying to drive the business to the next. You also may have to make sure you paid all the bills and you actually have a flight ticket tomorrow or not. You know, it's different now.
That's great. And the last question on that topic is on the, let's say, board membership, the board of Mercury Partners. I think on the NASDAQ, there are some rules now for gender equality. And what do you think about like having more like rules, let's say, like not laws, but more rules coming more from top down? Like, what do you think about those?
No, I actually think we've experienced here in the Scandinavian countries that it's needed to be an accelerator of the change. And I think, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, whatever we've done in Norway as to paternity leave and cost for kindergarten and all these things has facilitated that, you know, women do work. We don't have a whole lot of women that stay at home in this country. So that's an important thing, and it comes from above. It also paternity leaves sort of gets the fathers to connect with the kids and take care of them on a, you know, have to be alone with the small kids. That makes a change, not just for those months. I think it makes a change for afterwards. And I think also with the board positions, and also, you know, as you've been, you know, in the government and everything, there are these kind of sentiments that we should show off gender equality. I think it has been important to normalize it. I think it's also to some extent maybe necessary to get to the first steps. Then maybe it's not necessary in 10 years or 15 years or 20 years. But, you know, we all want to be a company where you hire someone with previous experience. And per definition, as long as it's not equal, then you will continue with the same bias if you want to have people with prior experience. So someone needs to take the leap and be brave and hire someone that don't have prior experience.
Or a bit less.
Yeah. So that the next company then can hire them again as board members or whatever, because then they have had the experience. So I think it is necessary, and I think it's a good thing. And, you know, you can always fight about this. I don't want to be on the board just because I'm a woman. But I don't think it is like that. I think we need to stop. And, you know, we shouldn't start saying, oh, 50% needs to be women. We can start with something, and then slowly this will change. It will normalize. You will get more and more. With experience, you will get more and more that enter a board where you're not the only female. And then maybe sometime from now, it's positive. Obviously, everything is based on that. We do think it's a positive thing. But I feel that most companies do feel it's a positive thing to have the balance of the genders and other. So then I think we need to get there, yeah.
Because on the board, I remember, I was talking with Patch, and I know that it was much harder for them to find a woman that is fits in the board with the same experience. Was actually really, really difficult. Mm-hmm.
I'm so at least I enjoy being on the board. Yes. Yeah, thanks. And for me, it's a great experience as well. And I think you know, there's a diversity. I come with a different background on aspects than the other board members that are currently all there are male.
Is it you're the only
on the board? Oh, yeah. But that I think it should be positive. But I also think, you know, someone needs to take that decision and say, okay, we need at least one, and then we maybe want one more, and then I will have the experience.
One is already much more than zero.
Exactly.
Statistically.
Yeah. And then it goes into the right direction. And I will have that experience for the next board and et cetera. So, and then it's easier for me to also help motivate other females to be on the board. So it's a long journey. I don't think we fix it overnight.
It will take time, I mean. But as any, let's say, society changes, I mean, there's so many things to change on so many different levels that it will take. I went to a museum last week. There's a photo exhibition about, what was it, 1968 or 1969, like strikes for women rights.
Mm-hmm.
And the signs were like, women are not good only at typewriting.
Yeah.
And I mean, in most countries, women had no voting
rights. Yeah, yeah.
And you think, it's been 50 or 60 years, which can seem very long, but also can seem not that long.
Mm.
It's always hard to know, okay, is it changing fast enough or not fast enough? So it's tricky, but I think there's definitely some changes. When I saw it, I was like, okay, this seems like 200 or 300 years ago.
Exactly, yeah.
It seemed like.
And sometimes it's good to take, like, to look back 10 or 20 or 30 or 50 years to see that, you know, realize how much it has changed in the right direction. But there are so many differences in different European countries and also in other countries. We travel all the time. So I think that's also for Norwegian women that come from a country where they don't necessarily experience the gender differences as much, then I think they can be not prepared for what they experience abroad.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's, we know it. Yeah, I mean, I think you are traveling a lot. And
I am.
I talked about that. At least I know your October months, your end of flights.
Not only October, I think, Philip.
In general.
Yeah, in general. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's great. Maybe let's change to more Nykode and even your role. It's one thing that I think I already asked you, but I want to ask you again. I mean, you founded the company, but you are in a CBO role. You don't want to take the CEO role.
Mm-hmm.
What's behind
I think you know, my major driver has always been the company and the company's success. And I think starting a biotech company and coming from academia and believing that makes you the perfect CEO with all that entails, which does not have a lot to do with the science only, I think is not good for the company normally. As long as you are able to work very tightly with the CEO on the strategy and the science and you have a good collaboration, I don't think it's the optimal thing to move into a CEO role. There is. I mean, you can always structure this the way you want, but I think it's good to have someone in the CEO role that has done it before. Yeah. And I think that's what I still feel. I mean, I don't have, I think I could thrive being a CEO in a new company.
Yeah.
That is, you know, starting at an earlier phase than what we are now, because now I've already done it and I do work very tightly with the CEO on all aspects. But we do benefit a lot from that tight collaboration and coming from different angles. So I think it's good for the company. And I don't, you know, think it's good to take over the CEO role moving into a phase that you've never been involved in before.
Yeah.
I think that goes for many aspects. But then again, I have most likely, compared to a lot of other founders that come from academia, I've had a more interest in the strategies, the business development, the investor relations, what else is needed to make this company a success? And that has always been something that I felt was super important, because it doesn't help if you do a good experiment in the lab if it doesn't, you know, drive the company forward. And I guess that's the reason for the change from being the CSO
to the CBO,
in the end, so I could focus across the entire company and the strategies and how to move it forward in the right direction.
And at the end also, I guess, it's a letter or a title, but what you mentioned, how you structure it internally, it also makes a huge difference. I mean, you are from what you said, it sounds like you are doing with a lot of things across the whole company, and it's almost, I mean, I guess almost co-CEO, like, yeah. Then like, yeah. But I guess, I don't know in the Nordics how it is, but then some countries that don't like the co-CEO thing, like in France is like completely unknown.
Yeah.
In Germany it's very common. You always have two or three managing directors.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, and it doesn't really matter. I didn't, I think what you said, that
I don't think it matters what we call ourselves. Yeah. Yeah.
Bring the best value and that it benefits the company.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we benefit a lot. This company benefits a lot from me and the CEO collaborating so tightly. So we do a lot of the business development things together. I mean, we're the ones that were negotiating the deals with Genentech and Regeneron, leading those discussions together. That's the two of us that's been on the road for this capital raise that we did this week, talking to all the investors together. And, you know, we complement each other in what we can answer, so that we cover everything in the company. So we don't have to take a lot of the questions back in those meetings and say, oh, I'll go and check with someone internally and then come back with an answer. Most of the things we are able to answer in the meeting at the level that is needed there. And I think that drives us forward in the right direction. And we get all that feedback from the external world as well that we can take home and discuss amongst the entire leadership team as to where should we go and what is the focus and the interest.
I like that. And I think it's also great to be as a, how you say, duet or whatever the word in English, at the top level, because it helps also a lot. It feels you always have the thing, like it's lonely on the top, but I think if you're two on the top, less lonely.
Yes, exactly.
And being together in the meetings also helps a lot to get feedback, share thoughts, discuss the same thing that has been lived.
Yeah. And I think that's like all the dinners, all the airport lounges, etc. It is a constant discussion about the last meetings, the sentiments, what should then be the focus and the topics, and what should we tell back to the organization, and what should we tell the board, etc. So I always liked it. I also liked it when I was CSO, because I was on the road quite a lot when I was CSO. Obviously, the company was smaller, but this opportunity to then be out there, talk to potential partners, talk to investors, you know, understand what is of interest and what do they think is just boring. It's not always that you can have that same sense if you are just working in the lab and you see, I get good results here and I get good results here. But which of those experiments are the ones we should pursue further in order to make this company do something that is of interest for patients and shareholders in the end then?
I mean, in a way, your investors and your partners are your indirect customers. And they're the gateway to the patients. So even in even in tech companies, just like talking to the customer helps them to funnel it back into the product.
Yeah.
So I think
that's where I thrive the most, when I'm allowed to be there, like in the middle, so we can... We can try to take the right decisions that we are proud of in a half a year or a year from now, because we made something that was differentiated and meaningful for the patients.
But it's also extremely hard position, also hard to get this experience and get this, like, I can talk super deep about the science, the clinics, but also investor relations in New York and the business, the strategy, making a deal. I mean, it's a very large range of skills and experience sets.
Yeah.
Which, I mean.
But in principle, you need it a bit early as a founder and, you know, in the leadership of a very small company. There is normally, at least here with the limited funding, you don't have the best CBO and the, you know, you don't have investor relations, right? In the beginning, so you need to take care of everything. Obviously, maybe I was a bit more interested in that part than all founders. But I'm also, you know, maybe extremely curious and I like to do new things.
So new thing.
I think in these companies, always for me, been for the best of the company. So if someone comes in and covers, you know, like I even had to do like manufacturing in, you know, a short period that I never necessarily liked or excelled at it. You know, then someone comes in and can take that position, then I can pretty quickly move out of the daily operations and the decisions in that aspect. And then I can focus on something else where we do have a gap still. And that's maybe something I like, that there is always somewhere we have a gap. And I love it every time someone comes in and can cover part of what I'm doing today. So I don't have to take everything on board anymore. Obviously, this company is growing all the time. So that's part of the journey. And some of those processes have been more painful than others, also for me and also for those that come in, obviously. But I think that's what I like. If there is a gap, what can I do to fill it?
I mean, you grow also, I mean, curiosity and personal growth, and you grow also in this pain as long as it's kind of bearable.
Yeah.
And the challenge brings a lot of stimulation or mental stimulation.
Yeah.
We could talk further about...
Not a routine person, maybe.
And you, I think you announced from this week that you raised, so it's $45 million, mm-hmm. if I convert in dollars. It's a private placement with new international investors. Mm-hmm. I mean, coming, what you said, being in the meeting and closing it. And I mean, at the moment also, it's not the easiest time necessarily to often close. So
yeah.
Can you talk a bit about it, or like what?
No, it's been very interesting. I think as a background information, obviously we are born in Oslo in Norway, and we're not a VC as such funded the company in the beginning. It's in Norway. It's been some interest from local family offices, etc., that are not necessarily healthcare specialists, but had an interest in biotech. And those local investors have been very loyal and been with us all the time, but we haven't been in the market for any capital raise since 2018, which is very rare for a biotech company.
You had upfront payments.
Because we got the upfront payments, like $200 million from the Genentech deal, and then subsequently $50 million from Regeneron, and then some milestones. So we spent the time really to trying to build this company and execute, but simultaneously knowing that at some time in the future, this company will need specialist investors and also specialist investors with really big funds in order to support the ambitions we have. We have a platform technology. We can make multiple different products within oncology. We can multiple products within now autoimmunity if it works. And that gives us an ambition to build a big company in the future if it succeeds. And then Norway is most likely not big enough for really supporting a company with this, and also that understands what's the difference with medium over overall survival of this compared to that, etc. What's the difference if it's a single arm with these data versus randomized? You know, what's open label? You know, these kind of come out of details we need to have more specialist investors on board. And now the market has been horrible the last few years. And it has made it challenging as to know when are we going to raise, because we still had like $174 million dollars in the middle of the summer. So no immediate rush. But if we want to support the journey of this company, we need to slowly first get some high specialist investors on board. They don't buy the, you know, normal stock on the Oslo Stock Exchange. They want to be part of a capital raise. So we've been on the road for a long period of time trying to get everyone to know this company that was born in Oslo and familiarize them with the technology, and now getting some of the really, really, really best funds to say, I'm interested, and I'm interested to the extent that I say, let's do it now. So we got particularly this one big fund. It's not yet public, but I think it will be soon. I'm super proud of being able to start the collaboration with this fund, starting with a $20 million from those, and then obviously made it easy to get the interest from the rest. I think it was multiple times oversubscribed, and in these markets, that's not normal. So that means a lot for us. I think we are now, I feel that we are now at the second sort of platform. I think for me it was, you're climbing and then there's a platform, and Genentech came on board, sort of, okay, validating the technology, also a lot of funding. Now it's also been a lot of climbing, but now I feel it's like it's hard to get us down from this level of validation that we have now as well. So very important for us days.
And I guess also what you said about, I mean, Oslo, I guess it's also pretty small, I mean, a smaller investor community. They've been very helpful, but I guess you rapidly tap into European or even US investors, and especially US investors for big money. Like most of the European companies, they get the bigger funding from
I think if you're like a single asset company, you can do very well in Norway, but I think as a platform company, in the future, if this is to be successful, we need as we also said, that we are obviously exploring a potential listing at the Nasdaq in the future, and in order to get there, you should not go there with primarily local investor base. So this is an important step also for a future successful Nasdaq listing for us.
That's great. Going to maybe more to the science, I mean, and how the science works starting from the beginning. I'm curious, maybe you can just on the short, like how the science really works. How are the antigens really shown to the APCs? I have some questions there.
Exactly. Yeah. Pardon my recent point. It is a complicated technology in principle. It's not that easy to explain in simple words. We focus on immunotherapies, primarily vaccines in principle, meaning that we want the immune system to elicit an immune response to certain antigens, we call them. And antigens can be like the COVID spike protein, if it's an antigen people know about. Or it can be antigens that are present in tumor cells or something that the immune system overreacts to in autoimmunity. And every time you elicit an immune response towards something, the antigen has to be processed and presented within an antigen-presenting cell. So it's a certain subtype of cells we have in our immune system that is super important. And that was the original idea, just to make sure that these antigens do get effectively delivered and loaded into these antigen-presenting cells. We sort of combine the antigen with a molecule that binds to these cells specifically. So that was the original idea. But then again, realizing that different targeting units, so what we use in order to bind to the antigen-presenting cells, they will all bind to different subtypes of these antigen-presenting cells. Yeah. And when they bind, they will be sort of internalized with different kinetics, so how rapid. And they will also go into different compartments. And all of these things determine whether you get this immune response profile or this immune response profile towards the same antigen. So that again gives us the opportunity to sophisticate the technology and make sure that for cancer, we know we want primarily CD8 killer T cells towards the antigen. We want it to multiple of the antigens, etc. And there we identified a targeting unit that makes sure the antigens goes to a certain subtype of antigen presenting cells and it's routed within those cells in a way that gives us the broad and strong CD8 T cell response. And that is something we apply for all cancer vaccines. Then for autoimmunity, that
just we just... I still follow.
Yeah.
Just for the... for how you present the antigen to the antigen, to the APCs, like what's... like, so you can engineer to select which kind of APCs will pick it up or like, and then how do you, what's the delivery mechanism there? Like,
yeah, so all APCs have different surface receptors. So for cancer, we actually use a chemokine, an inflammatory chemokine as the targeting unit. So this is sort of linked to the antigen through a dimerization unit. Yeah. So when this is expressed or you give it and deliver it, we do it intramuscularly. Yeah. Then the chemokine part of our vaccine actually attracts primarily dendritic cells, certain types of dendritic cells, so that these ends up being in the muscle cell, basically, you know, in the context of where the antigen is. Yeah. So it's very effective because the antigen is taken up sort of by the neighboring cell. So that makes it very effective to load the antigens. But then again, when it binds to the chemokine receptors on these particular APCs, it triggers internalization through a different compartments within that dendritic cell as if it didn't have the chemokine.
Okay.
And if it has the chemokine, it goes into sort of endosomes, lysosomes, etc. And makes the epitopes be more effectively loaded and presented on MHC class 1 molecules or HLA class 1 molecules, which gives us, when we look at all the data, we see a broader T-cell response. So if you have a large antigen, we can get a T-cell response to multiple different regions. Yeah. And these are primarily driven by CD8 T-cells. And we see that if we change the targeting unit, it will go to different subsets of antigen-presenting cells and maybe into different compartments. So we have identified the targeting unit for our oncology platform that gives us, you know, independent of which antigens we use, a differentiated T-cell response that is optimal for the immune responses.
So the platform is really, or like the IP and the platform is really there of like, being able to present different kind of antigen and deliver it to the APCs and make sure that there will be the correct response for a certain type of
cancer. Exactly.
Okay. That's
super good. Easy. Yeah, and that's what we're now using in a complete different direction. It looks very similar, but then if we change the targeting unit, we can make sure the antigens are delivered to tolerogenic antigen-presenting cells and be internalized in a different manner and give a different signal to that cell so that the immune response we trigger is still antigen specific, but it will be regulatory CD4 T cells.
That's what I mean.
And that's what we use in order to then make sure that we get a response that is applicable to treat autoimmune diseases. We can work on this for like other aspects that will be more optimal for treating certain bacterial diseases or viral diseases, etc., in the future. But so far, we now focus on oncology and autoimmunity.
Yeah, that's and I think I've seen from your last presentation that you will, I think, announce a candidate by the end of the year in autoimmune. But
no, that's in oncology. Yeah.
Okay.
In oncology. Yeah.
But you already have assets in autoimmune
No, autoimmunity is very new for us. So that's where we're working on identifying the optimal platform. And now we, back in September, presented some very convincing and nice data in preclinical models. Yeah. And it's in a sort of MS-like model and a type 1 diabetes model, but it's smart that there are, you know, preclinical models where we can test the principle. So we haven't decided which disease we will move forward with. We will start that work, or we have started that work, to identify our first candidate, but also in parallel, you know, really identify, as I said, with this particular chemokine. That's the one we use for all oncology. For our autoimmunity programs, we still need to decide exactly which targeting unit. We have multiple that seem to work. We need to find the best one. And also, should we give it as DNA or protein or mRNA, or, you know, we have all these abilities to change.
That was my next question. So
yeah.
on the form you're giving it, so for oncology, if I understand well, the antigen is already synthesized and combined with the chemokine.
In the clinic, we so far worked with a simple DNA plasmid-based vaccine. So we have the plasmid backbone that has then the chemokine as the targeting unit, directly linked to the genes that encode the dimerization unit, directly linked to the genes encoding the antigen. So it will, after we give it intramuscularly, it starts to secrete this fusion protein.
When you inject, your plasmid will automatically transfect into cells.
The muscle cell secretes this new protein that is not just the antigen, but then at the protein level, the antigen is linked to the targeting unit through a dimerization unit.
So I'm still curious about when you inject it, how it's automatic, it transfects automatically or goes into the cells to be expressed?
So it's not very effective if you just like take a needle syringe. With DNA, you need to either formulate it in some sort of formulation that makes it cross the cell membrane, or what we're using is a simple device, the jet injector, that basically gets it with enough speed.
Is it like a gene gun?
It's not a gene gun as such, but it's just like, it's a tiny orifice and a spring. So it just pushes it instead of a needle. Pushes it through the skin and into the muscle at such high speed that and it meets enough resistance. So it spreads and it goes, you know, across the cell membrane and gets into the cells. So that's very patient-friendly way of delivering it. In principle, this device is also being explored as an alternative to needle syringes, also for those with needle phobia and other aspects of it. So it's a very simple device, and I mean, we came over that bit of a coincidence many years back, and we are one of the first companies that tested this for DNA vaccines in the clinic. Not the first, but one of the first. And so far, it seems to allow protein expression, and without too much of this adjuvant activity. That's the things we're also thinking now when we see the clinical data. It seems that we generate T cells that, you know, come up, and they are not, it's a DNA, so the protein is being expressed over a long period of time, compared to, for instance, mRNA, or if you give the protein, it's sort of a very short period compared to the DNA. But also, there are obviously some adjuvanticity, you can say, with the chemokine, some CpG motifs in the DNA, but not as much fuss as with an mRNA, for instance. So we don't see any signs of exhaustion of the T cells. And we also see these very long-term, long-lasting T-cell responses that even 1 year after the last dose in our patients and on the trials we looked at, we still see effective T-cell responses. That may be, you know, a good thing with the DNA and with the jet injection, where we have the IP to deliver it as an mRNA-based vaccine if we wanted to.
Yeah.
We don't necessarily know all the differences in the kinetics and how that will affect whether we get more exhaustion of the T cells if we move forward with mRNA versus DNA or not. That's something that we would potentially like to explore with a partner.
You're looking into it as well.
So we have preclinical data with our vaccine formulated as an mRNA LNP vaccine. Those data look good. I mean, if we compare it with the standard mRNA-based vaccine that only express the antigen, we see the same benefits when we add this chemokine.
Yeah.
We see faster, we see a stronger, we see also very importantly a broader, meaning two more epitopes. And that that obviously is of interest. It seems in that aspect as an improvement of the current mRNA-based vaccines, particularly then with this chemokine for oncology purposes. So it's intriguing to also get that tested. But we are also so happy with the data we have on the DNA. So let's see if that's you know, maybe more likely that we would explore with a partner with the mRNA competence.
I guess I want to say that some mRNA companies must be also intrigued.
They could potentially be a bit intrigued.
And pretty deep pockets at the moment. What I was curious also is, I forgot my question. But on the results, I mean, this also explains the positive results you had. I mean, I just looked up from this year, so positive phase 2, mm-hmm. April 2023, mm-hmm. was a combination with a PD-L1 from Roche, Tecentriq, in advanced cervical cancer, and also what. I mean, super nice results first. I mean, especially for phase 2.
Yeah.
You doubled the median survival rate, and also you had a lot of very long-lasting, remission-free response, which I guess also comes from what you just mentioned, that the DNA injection generates a very long-lasting T-cell response.
Yeah.
Can you expand a bit more on the clinical, on the results, on... Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in principle, we tested this particular asset, VB10.16, earlier in a preclinical or in a precancerous cervical lesion setting, where we sort of knew that it was safe, could elicit very strong and long-lasting T cell responses, as well as we saw a very nice correlation with lesion size regression. This is obviously much earlier stages, and it was monotherapy. So we had very strong belief in the asset as such and its opportunities. Then we quite rapidly designed this trial that's called VBCO2, with testing this VB10.16 in advanced cervical cancer. And I think over the period, we as management, so we didn't see the results, right? But getting more and more concerned about opening the book and looking into this data, because of realizing that the patients coming into the trial is not only having one prior line of systemic anti-cancer therapy, but 2 and 3 and 4 and 5, you know, really late stage cancer patients. And cervical cancer is per definition a high unmet medical need patient population from the start, and getting really the sickest patients into the trial is, you know, challenging and risky from an opportunity to see that the vaccine has the ability to change it.
Especially in the immunotherapy setup, I guess. Yeah. Immune system is already very...
Immune system is and it's a lot of inflammation in the blood, and it's not the optimal setting. We're not set up for success. And then in the meantime as well, we saw other cancer vaccine companies moving away from late stage in any indication, and all almost focusing on this early stage adjuvant setting. So we were quite concerned, I would say, about whether those data would give us anything that we could build upon for future development. And I think we were so happy the day the team had worked like on this for a few days before I got to know it, which is the worst periods in my life. And then presenting the data with a lot of enthusiasm. This was first the interim data a year before, where we saw, oh, really, that looks very promising. And then a bit more optimistic when we should have the final readout. But the overall survival data being as strong as they are, I think that's transforming for the company, and obviously most likely also facilitates that we could do this capital raise now with interest from specialist investors and really, you know, move this forward into now a potential registrational trial. So for me, also super important days.
I mean, that's the dream. I mean, a positive phase two efficacy for other biotech companies.
Yeah.
It's huge. I mean, you talked about reaching plateaus.
Yeah, that's a plateau. That's a huge one. It is, absolutely. Yeah. And I know, you know, our chief development officer is planning these days where he had like paper printouts all over his floor, you know, every single patient, you know, double checking. How long they survive and how long they actually progressed, et cetera, before coming to us and presenting the results. So those days are extremely, extremely, and you have to make so sure that everything is correct before we go out. And it feels much better afterwards. It's a single arm trial, but it's a single arm trial will, you know, what looks like be at least a doubling on the medium overall survival. Now the new data came out now with the Skyscraper 04 trial testing again this Tecentriq in more patients and in PD-L1 positive patients, again heavily supportive for us, repeating that medium or so I was less than 11 months, meaning that we get more and more confirmation that these VB10.16 seem to help patients, and that's what we're here for.
Talking about the, if we zoom out a bit on the immunotherapy field, I mean, it's just massive breakthrough and massive benefits for patients, the PD-1, the PD-L1. At the same time, I heard that quite some other checkpoint inhibitors or some other pathway didn't work as well. And I think a lot of combination trials also didn't work that well. I mean, the one that works that comes to my mind is the one that Moderna did with Merck.
Yep.
I think that was very positive, especially for other mRNA cancer vaccine.
Yeah.
Can you expand a bit there, like kind of a zoom out view on where does the field stand?
No, I think we definitely experienced also when the Merck Moderna data came out that it was very much creating a boost in the interest of cancer vaccines in general. So I think these things are super important and it supports the entire field. Moderna's data are with personalized or individualized cancer vaccines, which we are also heavily invested in. We have partnered our individualized or personalized cancer vaccine program with Genentech and are doing studies together with them so far in advanced setting, but obviously it's of more and more interest also to move into earlier stages also with our assets. And I think they are supportive as to cancer vaccines should have a role. I think in the future that cancer vaccines should be the first thing you're offered when you have a diagnosis. There are really, as far as we know, there are no safety issues with a cancer vaccine compared to all other cancer treatments out there. And all cancer immunotherapies basically do work one way or another because they allow cancer-specific T cells to be functional within the patient. So adding a vaccine or just giving the vaccine first, which its primary role is to generate those cancer-specific T cells, should also always be a basis in every single patient as long as there's a cancer vaccine available. So I do believe that if we look...
The cancer vaccine is also effective, I mean, shows good efficacy
as well. Yeah, and it should show most likely more efficacy the earlier you come in the treatment. Yeah. So I think the entire field is moving in that direction to get cancer vaccines in as early as possible. I do, however, think that while some of the other cancer vaccine developers have stated that they've basically given up on advanced setting for cancer vaccines and think it's too challenging, I think our data clearly indicates that with this differentiated immune response profile that we generate, that we can help patients also that have failed other therapies. So we will not limit ourselves to only early stage adjuvant setting, but obviously also want to operate in that space. And I think the data we've seen, if you see, is like long lasting T cell responses. We really see very few patients progress if they first have either stabilized or had a resist response. That tells us that in an adjuvant setting after surgery, the likelihood of this vaccine really helping the patients to not get recurrence is very high. So we obviously want to operate in that space. I think the fact that some of the other cancer vaccine developers have stated that they've given up after failures in advanced setting, they also see maybe some signs that it works much better in adjuvant setting if it's even ctDNA negative versus ctDNA positive, meaning as long as there are, you know, tangible amount of tumor cells present, it is more difficult for some of the other cancer vaccine technologies to really provide a meaningful clinical benefit. I believe our technology with the differentiated CD8 dominant T cell response to multiple epitopes over time can be the right platform in advanced and in early stage.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually the question I forgot. That, I mean, what's interesting is that you are, you know, you could be potentially agnostic of DNA or RNA, so that's whatever delivery possibility, if you're agnostic of advanced or early stage, I mean, this makes it as a platform.
Yeah.
And if you're agnostic of cancer and autoimmune, then it starts to...
Exactly. That's why the growth ambitions are pretty big. Opportunities are big, but we also, I mean, we do have partnerships. So Regeneron is working with the three oncology programs and two infectious disease programs. I see with the mRNA data that we broaden the scope of potential partners that would be interested. So far, since we have focused ourselves on the DNA, even though we said, I mean, you can use mRNA if you want to, having more of these data available makes it also likely that we broaden the scope of potential partnerships in the future. So, and then let's see what works best in the end.
Yeah. I mean, it's also a bit the chicken and the egg thing. I mean, you have to start somewhere and what's in your control is to generate the data.
Yeah.
And I guess advanced patient is also a way to have a proof of concept. I mean, showing there and then going up the...
Yeah.
Going earlier. Because I can imagine, or at least from my knowledge, hearing from a lot of biotechs, it's very, very hard to access cancer patients earlier.
Yeah.
More from a recruitment and from a trial design.
Yeah, a bit dependent, I think, on you know, safety profile and things. But yeah, I think it's getting easier than it was 10 years ago to move into earlier stages. Also for us to do combinations with checkpoint inhibitors, because we see checkpoint inhibitors do move earlier and earlier. So now we recently got strong indications that Keytruda or pembrolizumab will get approval in adjuvant setting in cervical, which is why we are now pursuing a combination with that in earlier stages of cervical cancer, and expecting potentially to see the same sort of movements in head and neck soon, which opens the space. So I think it's easier and easier to get access to those patients, but those trials do take longer before you get to the proof of concept. You need more patients because they are healthier per definition, so it takes longer before you get the readout. That's the good thing with advanced, if you look at it from a development perspective, but not from any other perspective. So I think we're on the right path. So we started with late stage, can move to earlier stages. We started with DNA, we can broaden if we want to through partnerships, etc. And now we focused on oncology, expanded autoimmunity. We can do other diseases in the future if we want to, but let's focus.
Step by step.
Let's do it step by step.
From the combination, you could also do it as a standalone, or it just works better in combination?
No, I mean, so interesting. As I mentioned before, we have done a monotherapy study in precancerous cervical lesions, which looks good. So I think it depends on, you know, how sick the patients are potentially. Yeah. But actually in this CO4 trial that we are about to start, there we will have the first part of that trial will be testing VB10.16 plus Tecentriq versus VB10.16 alone. I believe that the combination in second line patients, as this will be, will have a higher likelihood of providing the optimal clinical efficacy.
In the trial, you will test your VB0.16 alone in combination with the checkpoint inhibitor, and then the checkpoint inhibitor alone as well?
No, not the checkpoint inhibitor alone. Yeah, because these patients have just failed Keytruda or pembrolizumab. So the investigators and the community does not believe in rechallenging with another checkpoint inhibitor alone. So it doesn't make sense. So probably very hard to recruit patients in that arm. So in that particular setting, it doesn't make sense.
One in combination, one not in combination.
Exactly. Yeah. So it also gives us some, you know, level of contribution of the components, which for FDA is so important.
Yeah. Nice. Just to finish or to wrap up, but connected to Oslo. I mean, we have an amazing view here, the whole fjord. Shot so many people can see it in the intro. And how was it to start the company here? Besides, is there access to some investors or generous investors? How was it here? And also, I think you have an office in Copenhagen already, and maybe one in the US soon. I don't know. so how was that from a location point of view, connected to your story since 2006?
Yeah. No, I mean, the headquarters is here basically because that's where it all started. I did my PhD across the road.
Yeah, the university.
in principle. So that's where we started. It's been good to found a company in Norway, but it's, you know, honestly, it's very few biotech companies and not all biotech companies that were around are around anymore, which is logical. No, it's fewer and fewer, maybe. Then there are new things coming up, which we hope will succeed. And that has made it more challenging, I think. Also from the, you know, the entire value chain with, so there is not a strong VC community here, maybe getting better. But compared to Denmark, for instance, it's very different. Since there are no, you know, not a lot of other biotech companies, it has been more challenging, not necessarily the first part with having people working in lab, because I think there's a very strong academic science community here, but to take those decisions as what am I doing with that science? How should we move it forward? The development part of this, the business development part of it, there is not a lot of prior competence that we can access. So that's one of the reasons now that we've grown into a company with, you know, close to 180 employees is that we set up an office also in Copenhagen, where they do have a longer history of biotech, and also biotech that has entered into the later phases, so that you have, you can access competence that have done it before. As I say, I still, you know, also here believe that we do break boundaries, but we don't need to break boundaries without having people that have already prior experiences. So that's the Danish office is around 30-35 employees, and where we have more of the late stage regulatory development people, a lot of management at the moment. While here we have the labs, all the preclinical, a lot of CMC. So that works as a good combination.
That's amazing. I mean it, and it is an amazing office in the whole science direction. Like this night, yeah. It looks really nice, and I think they're also building up.
Yes, another life science building here. So they are trying to build this industry. I think we are now a bit separated, right? So we have this very nice floor. We have the lab in one end of the building, and we're a bit separated as a company. But there are also a lot of benefits. So. Or being in a science park where the infrastructure and also the opportunity to connect with other companies.
Oh, great. I think that's a great final word. I mean, congrats on the whole journey.
Thank you.
I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing for the ecosystem here, for patients, for everyone. I mean, it's great. So, and thanks a lot for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you, Philip, for coming.
I really enjoyed the conversation. I mean, it's open on such a sensitive topic and the company she's built. I hope you enjoyed it too, and thanks for listening to the end. If you did, please hit the like, subscribe button on any platform you are. You can also leave a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Any of these actions will help us a lot. And I would also be curious to hear what you think. So you can please leave a comment on YouTube, Spotify, or any platform. We are reading all the comments, or you can also shoot me an email at philip@flot.bio. All right, now time to get back to Berlin, and see you in the next episode.